Welcome to www.meeknessandtruth.org, a teaching and ministry website of Dr. David Geisler. Now join him for Conversational Pre-Evangelism, Part 4.
I will awake in the dawn.
Let me just kind of do a little review. First of all, we've been talking about this model, this pre-evangelism model called conversational evangelism. And I said conversational evangelism involves four types of conversations that we want to have with people. Hearing conversations, illuminating conversations, uncovering conversations, and building conversations. And I said that corresponds to four roles we can play: the musician, the artist, the archaeologist, and the builder. All right? And last week, we went over the last two key points. I said there are four key principles or points that I want you to remember about this model as you practice it. The first one is that you learn to listen, right? The second point is that we what? Identify the sour notes or gaps in people's beliefs. What was the third most important point we talked about last week? To learn to ask clarifying questions. What do you mean by? I hope you get an opportunity either in the next week or in the next month to practice that. What do you mean by? Fourth, what was the fourth most important point we talked about last week? We asked questions with three D's in mind. What are they? Ask questions in a way, don't look at your notes, look at me. Don't cheat. Surface doubt, minimize defensiveness, but most importantly, what? Create a desire. This is the most important thing about this model, is that you learn how to ask questions in a way that you surface desire in someone to either continue the conversation or specifically to hear more about Jesus. And I mentioned that Jesus was the master at doing this. He knew how to create an interest like he did with the woman at the well in John chapter 4. Now, I said as a musician, we want to listen and hear the sour note. As an artist, what did I say we want to do? Paint a picture by asking questions, right? So this morning, we want to take it the next step. We want to talk about the archaeologist. Now, what does the archaeologist do? He digs, doesn't he? He uncovers what's below the surface. Let me tell you why this is important when it comes to witnessing. I've discovered in my conversations with college students that the questions they ask me are sometimes not really the real questions or the real barriers. In other words, they aren't the real things that are keeping them from taking a step to the cross. And what I have to do is uncover what's below the surface and find out what is chaining people down. Because I find a lot of times what people say is a problem is not really the problem. And the real problems that people have that are keeping them from taking a step to the cross are below the surface. Proverbs 25 says this: the purpose in a man's mind is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. Isn't that a good principle? We need to have an understanding to know what's really going on in the situation. What's really below the surface? One of our trainers in California for our ministry says it this way: good apologetics requires people of understanding who have the patience and insight not only to deal with people's stated questions, but to go below the surface and speak to their true objections. That's what we want to do when we talk about uncovering conversations. Now, what's our goal here? Our goal is to explore what's getting in the way of taking a step to the cross. How do we do this? I'd like to suggest that there are seven specific steps that you and I can keep in mind that will help us in taking them to take steps to the cross. Let's look at those. First, determine whether the issue is a real concern or a smokescreen. I'm going to tell you something. I've been trained in Christian apologetics, how to answer people's questions about the faith. And I've discovered a lot of times in my conversations with people, especially college students, that a lot of times the questions that college students ask me are really legitimate questions. They don't really want an answer. It's a smokescreen. And maybe it's a way of kind of pushing me back. Like, for example, when people bring up the issue of the hypocrites. What about the hypocrites in the church? Well, is it because they're really concerned about these Christians that they live godly lives? No. They're just trying to push you back. They don't want you to talk to them about Jesus. And that's kind of a warning signal, right? That's kind of like shooting a cannonball over the bow of a boat, you know, just to warn you, just to say, stay back. And I think that's what people do sometimes. And so I think it's helpful when we talk to people that we determine when they have questions or concerns, whether they're really legitimate questions or they're smokescreen. Because I'll be honest with you, early on when I studied apologetics, I would answer people's questions and debate with people and argue with people, and I found a lot of times I was winning the battle, but I was losing the war. And I think that's what we do a lot of times, too, when we don't understand whether the concerns that people raise are legitimate or not, whether they really want an answer to their question. I remember talking to a student on a college one day, and he said to me, you know, I know everything you're saying to me is true, but I just got some things in my life I don't want to give up, okay? See, sometimes people really aren't wanting to engage us because they really aren't interested in the truth. And so we need to find out if people have legitimate concerns or not. So here's a formula I found very helpful. Helps me not to fall into kind of an argumentative approach with people and argue with people back and forth, because I find it just wastes time, wastes their time, and wastes my time, and we don't get anywhere. So I use a question like this. Somebody asks me a question, I'll say, you know, I think I might have an answer that might be helpful for you, but I'm curious. Before I answer your question, can I ask you this question? If I could answer your question in a way that would make sense to you, would that help you? Would that help you? Now, if they say to me, no, that wouldn't help me to more seriously consider belief in Christianity or God. If they've told me that, what have they just told me? They've told me that it's not an intellectual question. And so my thought would be, well, maybe there's some other kind of barrier. And trying to get them to be honest about that. Maybe your questions really aren't of an intellectual nature. Maybe there's other kinds of issues or concerns that you have. Is that possible? And I find that that's very helpful to use this kind of approach with people. If, say, for example, I'm talking to someone who says that they're an atheist or a skeptic, and I can't really pin them down to believing in anything, actually. So here's a question I would ask someone like that. If you could know the truth about religious issues, would you want to know it? I find this a very, very helpful question, because it clears the smoke. And it helps you to determine whether that person really has legitimate concerns or not. I remember talking to a student on a college campus one day, and I asked him that question, if you could know the truth, would you want to know it? And he paused for a moment, and he said to me, yes, I would like to know the truth. Okay, now that's a dialogue you want to have with someone, okay? So I'm just saying, keep these questions in mind. Why is this important to keep these kind of questions in mind? Well, let me just share the story with you. One of my former students in Singapore, my former seminary students, was supposed to apply what I taught in class and have a pre-evangelistic conversation with one of his friends. And one day he did this, and here's the story he told me. Listen to what he says. He said, I tried presenting him with some evidence to show him that the Bible is a reliably historical account But finally, after about an hour of us talking and sharing views, he said, even if you put all the evidence right in front of me, I still won't believe. I don't want to believe. I didn't know what else to say after that. That's kind of an understatement. Now, do you hear what's going on here? My former student had been talking to this guy for an hour and answering questions and objections. And he wasn't reading this guy's body language, like, I'm not interested. And finally, after an hour, this guy just said to him, look, it doesn't matter how much evidence you give me. I just don't want to believe. I don't want to believe. Heard the story about the little boy who stood up in church while the pastor was preaching. And the mother was shocked, couldn't believe it, and told the little boy, sit down. And the little boy said, I don't want to sit down. And the mother said, sit down. And the little boy said, I don't want to sit down. And the mother physically had to sit the boy down in the chair. And the boy said to his mother, well, I'm sitting down on the outside, but I'm standing up on the inside. You know, there's some people that just don't want to believe. And we need to be sensitive to that fact. That's why a question like this can be very helpful. Listen to what this student said. In retrospect, this is my former seminary student. In retrospect, I realized this student had been throwing up a smokescreen. And early in the conversation, I should have tried uncovering the real barriers by asking him something like, if I could answer your question, would it help? In other words, the student had realized what I was saying to him, that sometimes it's helpful to ask that kind of question. Secondly, once you determine that the question is legitimate, you want to determine what the nature of the barrier is. In other words, you want to determine whether the barrier is mostly an intellectual or an emotional question or concern or some kind of combination. For example, if someone asks me a question about the problem of evil, how can there be so much suffering? I don't assume that they want a C.S. Lewis kind of answer. You know what I say to that person? I'll say to them, is the reason why you're asking me this question is because someone you know, a family member, a friend, a coworker, has been through some kind of personal suffering or tragedy, and that's why this question is important to you? Do you know why it's important to ask that kind of question? Because what if I think that they want just an intellectual response? What's going to happen? I may miss my opportunity to minister to this person. So we need to be sensitive to knowing what are their barriers? What are the problems? Are there intellectual concerns? Are there emotional concerns? Or are there a combination? Many times, the barriers will be non-intellectual. So here's some examples of questions or concerns that could indicate some kind of emotional baggage. How could a good God allow so much suffering and evil in the world? Or if God is there, why doesn't he answer my prayers? Or here's another one. If God is real, how come there's so many hypocrites in the church? Now remember, I said this could be a smokescreen as well, so we just have to be sensitive to discern, is this a smokescreen, or is this a legitimate question, and we need to help them find answers? But we need to help them deal with some of the emotional baggage in their life. Now, here's some statements that could possibly indicate intellectual baggage. It doesn't really matter what you believe as long as it makes you a better person. This is a very common intellectual belief in Asia, that it doesn't really matter what you believe. As long as your religion makes you a better person, that's the important thing. Secondly, since so many people disagree on so many things, there can't be any one right answer. There can't be any one right answer. Or third, since the Bible's been mistranslated so many times, we really can't be sure of what the original said, and therefore we can't trust the Bible. Or as one student said to me one day on a college campus, it's been too long since Christ lived. So how can we really know what he said or did? With this particular student, I gave him a little pamphlet by William Lane Craig called the historical evidence for the resurrection. And I said, John, why don't you read this pamphlet and let's get together in about a week and you can just kind of give me your feedback on what you thought. Did this pamphlet help you in any way? So we got together about a week later and I said, so John, what did you think? Did this help you in any way deal with any of your intellectual questions? He said it really answered most of his questions that he had. So what did I just do? I just removed from John's mind the idea that his barriers are really intellectual. Now he has to wrestle with the fact that his barriers are really volitional. He doesn't want to believe in Jesus. It's not because the evidence isn't there. It's because people believe what they want to believe so they can do what they want to do. And we need to help people to be more honest about why they are not responding to Jesus Christ. See, I see the value of apologetics in evangelism. I see that if I can use it in a way to help remove their intellectual barriers, then I can help them to be more honest about what's really holding them back, what's really keeping them from trusting Christ. Now, they may have intellectual barriers. They may have emotional barriers. But let's be honest, that's not what the Bible says is the real barrier that people have. The real barrier is the volitional barriers. That's the primary barriers. Now, how do we handle tough questions that people ask us? I have found there's a principle we can use that can help us in our conversations with non-believers. I call this principle the boomerang principle. And the whole idea is this. When people ask us questions, we want to reverse the burden of proof. Reverse the burden of proof. So remember what a boomerang is? It's something you throw and then it comes back to you. So when somebody throws a question at you, practice the boomerang principle and let the question come back around on them. Let them feel the onus or the responsibility of the question. For example, if somebody says to us, isn't Christianity only a crutch? Now, based on what I taught you last week, what would be your next question? What do you mean by crutch? And by asking that question, do you see what I'm doing? I'm using the boomerang principle. I'm turning the question back around on them. What do you mean by crutch? In what way are we not crippled? You know? Open the newspaper. Turn on the TV. Look at the news. You think we're not crippled? Do you see what I just did? I just used the boomerang principle. Let me give you another example. What if somebody says to us something like this, I don't believe that the Bible is reliable. How do we turn that back around on them? Well, maybe I would ask a question like this. Why don't you think that the Bible is as reliable as other books of antiquity written around the same time period, like Josephus or Tacitus or Homer's Iliad? You know, remember Homer wrote about the Trojan cow? Do you remember about that? Oh, did somebody say it was a horse? Oh, it was a horse and not a cow? Now, if Homer wrote the Iliad in 800 BC, and we can know that he wrote about a horse and not a cow, and we can know historically that's true, here's the question you ask your non-Christian friend. How come we can't know that the things in the New Testament that were said about Jesus, how come we can't know those things are true? I'm not saying how come we can't know everything in the New Testament is true. How come we can't know that the basic facts about Jesus' life, what he said, what he did, how he lived his life, the miracles he performed, how come we can't know that's true? Now, do you see what I just did? I tricked you, didn't I? I used the boomerang principle. And that's what we need to do sometimes with people. If you can believe this is true, why do you think the Bible isn't reliable? And I can tell you from experience, they don't believe the Bible is reliable because they've studied it. They don't believe the Bible is reliable because they don't want the Bible to be reliable, especially true of college students. Why? Because then they're accountable. So you sometimes need to use the boomerang principle. Now, you may not be surprised to hear me say this because I've said this over and over. that Jesus practiced this principle as well. Isn't that something I came up with? Jesus practiced this principle. Look in Luke 20, verses 2 to 4. And they, the chief priests and scribes, spoke, saying to him, to Jesus, tell us, by what authority are you doing these things, and who is the one who gave you this authority? And what was Jesus' response? He asked a question, right? He said, and he, Jesus, answered and said to them, I shall ask you a question, and you tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or men? And what was their response? We don't know. So what was Jesus' response to them? I'm not going to answer your question either. So he used this principle. So I'm saying that a lot of times when people ask us questions, we feel, 1 Peter 3:15 says, to give a reason for every man who asks us for the hope within us, we're supposed to respond right away. And what I'm suggesting to you is sometimes it's better not to respond right away and not to give them an answer right away, but to turn the question back around on them. This is a good way to deal with hard, difficult intellectual questions that people ask. It helps them to be a little more honest about the questions or concerns that they're asking us. Third, uncover the specific emotional baggage that they are carrying. Do you realize that almost everyone, all the non-believers you know, have some emotional baggage in their life? That's a problem for them in taking steps to the cross. Look at this graphic. You see, I believe that a lot of people are weighed down by the emotional baggage that they carry, and that keeps them from taking a step to the cross. Sometimes they can't even hear what we have to say about Jesus, even if we share the gospel with them. Have you ever had that problem? Do you know why? What does 2 Corinthians 4:4 say? It says, the God of this world has what? Has blinded their minds so they may not see the light of the gospel. And sometimes what we need to do is we need to ask God wisdom for discerning what the real issue is that we need to address when we're talking to our pre-believing friends. We need to understand what are some of the emotional baggage. Remember the Baptist friend that I've made recently that I've been talking to? You know, it took me a while to find out why he hasn't been going to church. But I found out some of the emotional baggage that's keeping him from going back to church. And then I was beginning to talk and speak into his life and tell him, don't let the devil use this thing in your life to keep you from having fellowship with other believers. If you're a Christian and you have a relationship with Jesus Christ, don't let him do that to you. But I had to uncover what was below the surface. I had to uncover what was the baggage issues that was getting in the way. Let me give you a couple illustrations to make this a little more clear for you. One day I was on a college campus and I was talking to a Jewish atheist. I was trying to share the gospel with them, with a Jewish atheist. And after a few minutes, I realized I wasn't making much progress with this Jewish atheist. And he finally admitted this to me. He said that the last Christians that he talked to said that AIDS is God's punishment for homosexuals. No wonder why he wasn't listening to me. Do you see why? He was so angry at those Christians. And so I could share the gospel to him very clearly, and it would go in one ear and out the other. He would not hear a single word I said. The God of this world has blinded their minds so they may not see the light of the gospel. One day I was speaking on a college campus in the U.S., and an Asian student came up to me afterwards and asked me this question. Why do Christians seem nicer inside a church than outside a church? Ouch. Do you see what I'm talking about? Emotional baggage. Now, how do we handle emotional baggage when we deal with this with our non-believing friends? Let me give you a few suggestions. First, invite them to share their story. Invite them. Whatever their story is, whatever harm maybe some Christian has caused them, listen to them. That's the most important point of the model, right? When you invite them to share their story, listen to them, all right? Secondly, as you're listening to them, try to discern what are the most obvious barriers to the gospel as you empathize with them. Try to discern what those areas are. May not be easy, and that's why we need to ask God for wisdom. And so in every encounter I have with a non-believer, I'm trying to understand. I'm trying to understand with my neighbor across the street whose wife is Catholic and he didn't really grow up in any kind of religious background, but they got married in a Catholic church. What is that thing that's kind of standing in his way? What is the emotional baggage maybe that I'm going to have to deal with him before he's going to hear what I have to say about Jesus? I'm trying to figure this out in all my conversations with my neighbors. Third, if it's appropriate, affirm God's love and hope for them. If it's appropriate, affirm God's love and hope for them. Have you ever noticed that people feel a lot more hopelessness today than ever before? And I think we need just to remind them that in spite of all that they've gone through and all the trials, that yes, God does love them and that there actually is hope for them. There is hope. I find people need to hear this. Fourth, if it's appropriate, here's a very important point. Apologize. Apologize for how another brother or sister in Christ treated them. And what I said to this Jewish atheist that I talked to on a college campus one day, I said to him, I am sorry that these Christians said to you that AIDS is God's punishment for homosexuals. That was wrong. And in saying to him that was wrong, what was I saying to him? I was saying to him that, yes, there is such a thing as sin. And not only do we as Christians not live up to God's standard of what we should be, sometimes we don't even live up to our own standard of what we should be. And non-verbally, you know what I was saying to him? And that's why we all need Jesus. Do you see what I was doing? When I say, I'm sorry, I'm actually building a bridge, something we're going to talk about next week. I'm building a bridge with them. I'm helping them to understand that there is such a thing as sin, and that's our big problem. And that's why we need Jesus. And I'm hoping and praying that God would use that in his life to help them maybe kick the can down the road a little bit so that someday he'll deal with the sin issues in his own life and he'll make the decision to accept Jesus Christ. So apologize can be very helpful. Lastly, tell them you'll keep them in your prayers. I found that sometimes the most helpful thing you can do with your non-believing friends that you see on a regular basis who share personal concerns or problems in their life is to say, tell them that you will pray for them, but not use that as an opportunity then to shove the gospel down their throat, but walk away. You empathize, you tell them you'll pray for them, and you walk away. So the next conversation you see them, they know you're a safe person. You listen, you showed concern, you didn't use that as an opportunity to jump on them and share your, quote, religious perspective. And that may earn you the right to be heard for the next time. So keep these principles in mind. Fourth, determine whether there is a question or concern behind the question or issue raised. We talked about this at the very beginning today. That I find a lot of times the questions or concerns that college students ask me are not the real concerns or barriers. They aren't the real things that are keeping them from taking a step to the cross. And so you can answer people's questions, but if you don't deal with the concerns behind the question, you may not help them very much. In other words, the concerns are those things that they have that are, in a sense, negative attitudes or perspectives that they have towards us for holding certain beliefs. Now, Jesus was a master in getting below the surface. Let me share with you one passage where he does this. in Mark 12, 18 to 27, remember when Jesus was talking to the Sadducees and the Sadducees were asking Jesus this hypothetical question about who will be the wife's husband at the resurrection, right? And Jesus' response by pointing out that they don't know scripture because in heaven they neither marry nor are given in marriage. And then he gets beneath the question, right? So what was their true objection? Their true objection was they didn't believe in the resurrection. So what did Jesus do? Well, he pointed to an Old Testament passage in the Pentateuch. Now, why is that significant? The Pentateuch is those first five books of the Old Testament, right? They were the only ones that the Sadducees accepted. So Jesus pointed to a passage in the Pentateuch to make his point about the resurrection. And he used a present tense verb, implying that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are still alive, even though they had passed away many years ago. In other words, that there is such a thing as a resurrection. So Jesus points to a passage in the Pentateuch, Exodus 3:6, which supports the position that there is a resurrection. And by using a present tense verb, I am, he pointed out that there is such a thing as the resurrection. Now, this is what you and I need to do in our conversations with people. For example, if someone asked us this question, how can you claim that there's only one way to God? What might be the belief behind the question? In other words, remember I said that sometimes there are negative attitudes that people have towards us for believing certain things? What might be their attitude towards us for believing that Jesus is the only way? They may believe that we are arrogant, judgmental, narrow-minded, intolerant, good. These are all good answers, all right? See, do you understand what I'm trying to say here now? In other words, if you only answer their question, but you don't deal with the negative attitudes that they may have, you may not help them very much. So they may believe Christians are arrogant to think that they have the truth. And here's the other word I was looking for. And therefore better than other people. See, they may think we think that we're better than other people because we believe that Jesus is the only way, that we have the truth. And so what we need to do when we talk to them is we need to share Christ in the way like one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. Right? Because we have to get rid of that attitude that they have, that they may think that we think that we're better than them. They may believe that Christians are not very, here's the other word I was looking for, open to other faiths by being so, and I heard this word, exclusive, okay? People don't like the word exclusive. Now, how do we help them to deal with these kinds of negative attitudes? How do we dispel these negative attitudes that they have? Well, let me share with you some ideas for how to do this. This concept I've adapted from Dean Halverson's book, A Compact Guide to World Religions, where he talks about this whole idea of how do we explain to people that there can only be one way to get to heaven, all right? Remember, I was talking to a secular Muslim one day on a plane, and he didn't like the idea that Jesus was the only way, or the Christians even believe that Jesus is the only way. So here's the question I asked him, and it comes out of this principle that I learned from Dean Halverson. I said, how many ways are there for you to reconcile to your wife for something you said or did that really hurt her feelings, really hurt her deeply? I said to him, isn't there really only one way? Don't you have to either say or do something to communicate that you are, what's the word? Sorry. That's the only way, right? That's the only way you can reconcile. Now, here's the next point. If that is the way it is in our human relationships, why would that be any different in our relationship with God? God comes to us and says, you have to reconcile to me, and you have to say you're sorry. And the only way we can meaningfully do it is through Jesus Christ. That's the only way. Do you see what I just did? I talk about this, by the way, in chapter 8 of our conversational evangelism book. I talk about when someone asks a question, if we're going to help them to see what we want them to help them to see, we need to ask and answer four questions. What's the question behind the question? What are the terms we need to clarify? What's the truth we want this person to understand? And what's a story or illustration to illustrate the truth? And once we use that story, that human story, to illustrate the truth, that there can only be one way to do something, then we draw the inference to the theological truth, that God expects us to come to him in a similar way, that we have to reconcile to him and we have to say we're sorry. And it can only be through Jesus Christ. Do you see what I just did? Do you see the sequence of what I'm doing? I use an illustration to help them understand the truth, and then I make the inference to the theological truth. How about Christianity is too exclusive? Ladies, when you got married, those of you who are married, your husband excluded every other woman out of his life to have a special relationship except one, you. Now, ladies, isn't that a good thing? I don't hear any amens. So, exclusiveness isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, we see these commercials where we're told that we need to exclude drugs out of our life. They're bad for us. And even cigarettes are bad for us. So exclusiveness isn't necessarily a bad thing. And this is the point we try to make with our non-Christian friends. The real issue is, what are you including in your life and why? And what are you excluding and why? We need to help people understand that. Fifth, find out what their biggest barrier is to Christianity. Now, why is that important? You know, I find that non-believers can have a lot of barriers to the faith, and you're talking to them, and they'll maybe share some of these barriers. But if you cannot find out what is that one thing that's keeping them from taking a step to Jesus Christ, putting their faith in Jesus Christ, if you can't find out that biggest barrier right now, you may not make much progress with your friends. Because in their mind, they just see all these barriers. They're not conceptually thinking, well, what is that one thing that if it's removed will actually help me take a step to the cross and make a decision for Jesus Christ? Because we don't have all the answers. I don't have all the answers. Now, I find that this is a very helpful principle. In fact, let me tell you a few stories. One of my former seminary students in Singapore came to me one day and said that she took this a principle and applied it to her seeker friend that she was talking to. And she asked her that specific question: what is keeping you right now from putting your faith and trust in Jesus Christ? And that friend realized there was nothing keeping her from putting her faith and trust in Jesus Christ. And right there and then, that friend prayed to receive Christ just by asking the question. A while back, I also was doing this seminar in a church in Singapore, and I was doing a series, and I made this point one week, and then the next week a lady came up to me and said she applied this principle, talked to two of her non-believing friends, and both prayed to receive Christ just by asking the question. So you may have a seeker friend that you've been talking to for a long time and has never made a commitment to Jesus Christ. Maybe you need to consider whether you should ask them this kind of question. What is keeping you right now from putting your faith and trust in Jesus Christ? And maybe that will crystallize in their mind what's really standing in the way. I find this a helpful question. Now, what are some of the biggest barriers? Well, in Asia, the biggest barrier is family obligations or expectations. That's the biggest barrier. One international student said to me this one day, one of my biggest barriers to belief in God or Christianity is that I'm not brave enough to consider religious issues solely without considering the consequences of what other people think. Yeah, this cat is pretty brave, don't you think? Sometimes we're not very brave, yeah. Right? Now, I have found in America that that's not the biggest issue. The biggest barrier is moral lifestyle choices. I've said this before. People believe what they want to believe so they can do what they want to do. And I find that especially true of college students. That's their biggest barrier. That's why they don't believe the Bible is reliable. They don't want to be held accountable to a holy and righteous God. And we need just to help them understand that, look, when you accept Jesus into your life, like I said to this one student one day, I said, you don't just make the decision to get your life cleaned up and then invite Jesus to come into your life. You make the decision to invite Christ to come into your life now and allow him to change you. Because what does Philippians 2:13 say? God is at work in us both to what? Will and work is good pleasure. It's like that student that said to me one day, you know, I just got some things in my life I don't want to give up. And what I explained to him is, see, you don't wait till you want to give up these things. You make the decision now, repent, turn 180 degrees, go the opposite direction, invite Christ to come into your life, and let him change you from the inside out. You cannot change yourself. It is only God that can change you. That's what we need to help people understand about moral lifestyle choices. I like my comfortable moral lifestyle choices. I know maybe it's wrong, but I don't want to give it up. You tell them they need to make a decision to invite Christ into their life and ask him to give them the desire and then the ability to do what you know you should do, because you don't have that ability in and of yourself. That's what I tell university students. Six, find out what would motivate them to get answers in these areas. Do you know why that's helpful? If you can't find out what would motivate someone to get answers to their concerns or questions they have about the faith, they may not be in the conversation long enough for you to uncover what's really below the surface. It's very important for us to find out what would motivate someone to want to continue a conversation with us. For example, one day I was talking to a college student, and he said this to me. I was kind of shocked. He said, my mother committed suicide 3 years ago, and I don't believe in God or Christianity, but I realize if there's no God, there's no ultimate meaning in life. And I'm not willing to accept that yet. So that student was willing to dialogue with me about Christianity, about Jesus Christ, about evidence for God. And he went, within 1 year, he went from a closed-minded atheist to an open-minded theist. Now, I don't know if he ever became a Christian. I lost track of him. You see why it's helpful to do that? Find out what would motivate someone to want to continue the conversation. I remember talking to this guy one day, and his mother died a few years ago, and he believes she's in heaven. He's Catholic. Guess what his motivation is for talking to me about Jesus? He wants to see his mom again. So do you see what I'm saying? In your conversation with your non-believing friends, find out what would motivate them to want to continue these spiritual dialogues, right? And seventh, lastly, I hinted about this earlier. Uncover the volitional factors. I said that people may have intellectual barriers, they may have emotional barriers, but the Bible teaches that our primary barrier that's keeping us from coming to Jesus Christ is volitional. But Romans 1 says they have some knowledge of God, and what do they do with that? They suppress it. They hold that down. Why? What does Ephesians 4:18 say? They are ignorant because of their hardness of heart. They don't want to believe. See, in this step, what we're doing is we're attempting to surface an unwillingness to believe that goes beyond just dealing with intellectual and emotional barriers. The Bible teaches that non-believers know the truth about God because God has made it clear to them, so they're without excuse. They have some knowledge of God. Romans 1 says that. Do you remember what was said about Jesus in John 12:37? But though he, Jesus, had performed so many signs before them, yet they were not believing in him. Now, let me ask you this important question. Why were they not believing in Jesus? Is it because he didn't show them enough evidence? They don't want to believe. And maybe you know people that just don't want to believe. And maybe they come to you and say, I don't want to hear any more what you say about Jesus Christ. I'm tired of hearing you witnessing to me. I don't want to hear anything more. Stop it. What do you do with a person like that who has these deep volitional barriers? The Bible says there are at least two things that we can do. First, we can pray for spiritual enlightenment. Pray for spiritual enlightenment. James 5:16 says this, the effective prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. Why is that important? Well, 2 Corinthians 4:4 says, the God of this world has what? Has blinded their minds so they may not see the light of the gospel. That's a very similar idea to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2:14. Listen to what he says here. But the natural man does not accept or welcome the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. Now, please understand, it doesn't say he cannot perceive the truth. He can perceive some of the truth. It just means he cannot receive. The Greek word here is dekomai, which means he cannot welcome or embrace the truth. You see, it's foolishness. The cross is foolishness to a non-believer, and you and I need to pray for spiritual enlightenment for our hard-hearted non-believing friends that don't want to hear what we have to say about Jesus. Pray that their eyes will be open. The second thing we can do is we can demonstrate Christ's love to them. John 3:35 says this, by this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Let me share with you a personal story to explain what I mean by this. A few years ago, my wife's grandma was in the hospital in Singapore. I told you my wife is Chinese-Singaporean. Her grandma came from China, and she doesn't speak any English. I don't speak any Chinese. But there was a period of time where none of the family members could be around her except for me. So I sat by her bed, I poured water in her cup, and I smiled at her. That's all I did. I couldn't speak the Chinese language. But word had gotten around in my wife's family of what I had done. And that had an impact on my wife's grandma. Not just her grandma, but all her family members that aren't believers. They saw something different in my life. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Remember the story I told you about my wife's uncle who passed away from cancer? Remember what I said was the turning point for him, or one of the turning points? It wasn't what I said. It was my tears. It was when I said to him, Uncle, when I get to heaven, I want to see you. And I started crying. That impacted him. He knew I cared for him. And it's our love for one another, for our non-believing friends, that will make a difference in our witness. So these are the 7 points. Determine whether the issue is a real concern or a smokescreen. Determine the nature of the barrier. Uncover the specific emotional baggage. Determine whether there's a question or concern behind the question, or find out their biggest barrier. Find out what would motivate them, and uncover the volitional factors. Now, I know this is a lot of material. And it is kind of like drinking water out of a fire hose. So I want to encourage you just to think about this, pray about this, and maybe just kind of think through who are the people that you know, that you've been witnessing to, that have emotional baggage issues or have some kind of barriers, and what can you do based on what you learned today that will help you to know what to do next.
Bring your glory, bring your voice.
The copyrights for this recording and its content are held by Dr. David Geisler.